This program is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation, on the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide, on the web at frostzelnick.com, and from one anonymous donor.
This is Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson. This program, Becoming Americans, is part two of a two-part journey through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. In part one, we follow the 2 million Jews who came to the United States from Eastern Europe around the turn of the 20th century. They were fleeing persecution and pogroms. They were also lured by the myth that the streets of America were paved with gold.
I was born in the Ukraine, Russia, 1901. News came from town to town that they're wrecking and burning houses and they're making a pogrom.
We didn't take anything to America. We had nothing to take to America. All we had to take with us were some bad memories, which we gladly left behind us.
When they arrived on the Lower East Side, they realized the streets certainly weren't paved with gold and life was extremely difficult.
My father had a watch, a gold watch with a fob, and he would put that in the pawn shop. And I would look at my father to see if he had his watch. That's how I knew when things were bad. Things were always bad. Things were always bad.
On the Lower East Side, there were over a half million Jews by 1910, 1912. So we're talking about the largest Jewish population in the world. It was predominantly poor and working class. So there was this vacuum. In the Jewish case, the vacuum was filled by radical intellectuals, people like Abraham Kahan.
Kahan was maybe the greatest figure in that world as editor of the Jewish Daily Forward.
In 1906, he put together the Bintel Brief.
A bintel is just a bundle, and a brief is a letter, a bundle of letters. It would be like a letter to the editor column, seeking advice, mostly about situations in life.
Dear editor, we work in a Bleecker Street shop. With us is a 13-year-old boy who works hard for the $2.50 a week he earns. Just lately, it happened that the boy came to work 10 minutes late. This was a crime the bosses couldn't overlook. And for the lost 10 minutes, they docked him 2 cents. Isn't that a bitter joke?
In this program, we'll look at work, unions, politics, and Yiddish culture through oral history excerpts from people who lived on the Lower East Side at the time. We'll also hear from historians and from tour guides who work there today. We'll see how the children and grandchildren of Jewish immigrants left the Lower East Side and eventually became fully American.
There were all kinds of types that you would find in the ghetto.
Kenneth Lebow, who with Irving Howe wrote The World of Our Fathers.
For instance, Barney Ross, who was a very famous boxer in the 30s and 40s, had a special job in a retail clothing store, and he was known, in Yiddish, it would be called a chopper. And a chopper, in English, is a puller-in.
Annie Poland, education director at the Eldridge Street Synagogue Project.
If you passed a millinery shop or a cloak shop, they would hire people who would literally pull people from the street into the shop.
The approved technique was not to grab him so hard that you tear his clothes, but to get a good enough grip so he couldn't slip out from under. If he said, "I have no money, I can't buy," I'd assure him, "Forget about money. This'll cost you nothing, practically nothing." If he said, "I've got 10 sweaters already," I'd tell him, "Listen, you need one real heavy sweater. It will save you money, and you won't have to buy a coat." Barney Ross, No Man Stands Alone.
Linen, linen, mild.
Tony Michaels teaches American Jewish history at the University of Wisconsin.
Jews were concentrated in the largest manufacturing industry in New York, the garment industry.
Zalman Milotek, director of the Volksbühne Yiddish Theater.
Cab Calloway tells a story and recorded this Yiddish folk song called Ota Zoi Neita Schneider. This is how a tailor sews. He heard it growing up in the tenements of Baltimore. And the Yiddish goes, Ota Zoi Neita Schneider, Ota Zoi Neita Doch. This is how a tailor sews. And Neita Neita Ganze Woche. He sews and sews a whole week. Verdient a Gilden mit a Loch. And he makes a penny with a hole in it, a wooden nickel. And Cab Calloway turned it into
Ota Zoi sings a tailor as he fashions pretty clothes. Ota Zoi sings a tailor as he sews and sews and sews. He's as busy as a bee, making lovely finery, things my baby loves to wear when I take her to the fair.
I went to work in this ribbon factory, putting a label on the top of a roll, what color the ribbon was and how many yards the roll had.
You were how old at this time?
I was 14. $3 a week for 6 days. You stood, you couldn't sit. 8 in the morning till 6, and Saturday 8 till 6.
You couldn't pick your head up and you couldn't say anything to anybody, because if you would, they'd come, the boss would come around and say, you're supposed to work, not at all. It made you feel bad, you're frustrated. But what could you do? You have to work, otherwise you wouldn't have what to eat. You know, you had to work or else you had to pay rent.
No one girl made an entire garment. As each girl completed her part, the garment was passed on to the next girl by Levinson, who was always walking back and forth, urging us. Should a girl lag behind, he would prod her, sometimes pulling on the garment to hurry it on to another worker. This sort of thing created a spirit of competition for self-preservation that ended only when the worker, too weak to compete longer with a stronger sister, broke down. Marie Gans, Rebels, 1919.
1908, esteemed editor, we were sitting in the shop and working when the boss came over to one of us and said, you ruined the work. You'll have to pay for it. The worker answered that it wasn't his fault. The boss got mad and began to shout, I pay your wages, and you answer back, you dog. The worker said no more. Did this unfortunate man act correctly in remaining silent under the insults of the boss? The worker cannot help himself alone. There is no limit to what must be done for a piece of bread. One must bite his lips until they bleed and keep silent when he is alone. But he must not remain alone. He must unite with his fellow workers and fight.
You are aware of what conditions in the shops are like. Dirty, dark, cold in the winter, hot in the summer. It doesn't take a great deal of intelligence or education to realize that those things are not what they should be. And if you have any brains at all, you learn from the elite of the labor movement, the socialist movement. You go to meetings, you listen to lectures, you read the paper that gives at least enough space to describe what things are like today and what they might be in the future.
Nat told us about a man by the name of Karl Marx, a name, he said, that was sacred to the working classes.
Rose Pastor Stokes married into the Stokes family, who were very wealthy copper barons in America. She started out her career as a sweatshop worker.
Kenneth Lebo.
Here's what Rose has to say. Keep in mind that these Jews have now rejected the Jewish God. They feel that he does not exist. If he does, he's not talking back, and they have to find some kind of replacement for this.
Karl Marx would show the workers how to abolish poverty. Poverty and misery and insecurity are not things that a cruel God puts into the world to punish us for our sins. Poverty and all its evils can be abolished, and the workers will abolish them through socialism. We need not suffer poverty. What a world-shattering idea. We the workers, will change it all someday. The how and when we didn't know, but the seed was planted.
Tony Michaels.
People will speak of a Jewish tradition of socialism that immigrants brought to this country. That's only partially true. The fact is that the Jewish labor movement emerged in New York prior to one emerging in Eastern Europe. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants came without knowing anything about socialism, without having any experience in the labor movement. That was something they discovered in the United States.
At a strike arbitration, there was no elation. One beautiful, wonderful day.
The first large strike wave among immigrant Jews happened in 1886 as part of a nationwide strike wave that came to be known as the Great Upheaval.
The workers' first sensation came with the realization that it was a higher wage we did seek. We pleaded in Yiddish and mumbled some British.
It's the largest upsurge of class conflict in American history up to that point, and immigrant Jews got swept up in it. Another even larger strike wave happened in 1890, then another one in 1893, 1894, and so on.
By night and by day, we asked for more pay, but this is all we could get them to say. No compreni, no capisci, no fashtei.
So class conflict and protest of one kind or another was a chronic feature of immigrant Jewish life.
One particular time when my father was on strike, my mother got a telegram that he was in jail because of picketing activities, and my father being religious wanted kosher food. I remember my mother's remark. She let out a traditional household curse word. If he's going to go on a strike, let him eat a geisha food. And she wouldn't send any food down to the jail.
So wissen gut die Kinderlich, der Tate wird nicht kommen.
Der Tate wird nicht kommen.
Sie ist der Tate heimt in Gas mit sein Bix vernommen.
Mit sein Bix vernommen.
Jews had a very difficult time unionizing.
The workers were interested in a strike, but in terms of longer running planning, that was hard to keep workers in a union.
The conventional wisdom held prior to 1909 that Jews made good strikers but bad trade unionists. It took more than two decades for Jewish workers to get their act together so that they know how to run and maintain a union.
In 1900, the ILGWU, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, was formed on the Lower East Side, and that was an attempt to gather in a lot of the smaller unions or the smaller groups together. And that really got off the ground November 22nd of 1909. A lot of shirtwaist factories had started to strike, and one of the leaders of this movement was a young woman named Clara Lemlich.
Clara Lemlich comes to the United States and starts working in the garment trades, and she's appalled by the long hours, by the sweatshop conditions, by the exploitation of children. She's only 15 herself.
The shops are unsanitary. That's the word that is generally used, but there ought to be a worse one. Whenever we tear or damage any of the goods we sew on, or whenever it is found damaged after we are through with it, whether we have done it or not, we are charged for the piece and sometimes for a whole yard of the material. At the beginning of every slow season, $2 is deducted from our salaries. We have never been able to find out what this is for.
New York Evening Journal, November 28, 1909.
In 1909, there's a call for a strike, and a lot of Jewish women turn out at Cooper Union in the Great Hall there in New York City, and they hear one speaker after another.
The place was jammed. The union invited Samuel Gumpers of the American Federation of Labor, Mary Dreyer of the National Woman's Trade Union League, and others to be the speakers.
and they kept talking and talking and talking, and finally, Clara Lemlich got up in the audience.
Lass mich besorgen.
Excuse me, miss, but you're not listed on this program. And in an event like this, we must proceed.
Clara Lemlich, let her speak.
One of the women got up and said, Mr. Chairman, we are tired of listening to speeches.
Workers, I'm tired of hearing speakers speak in generalities. I move that there should be a strike.
We need to strike now. And the room erupts in pandemonium.
And that's all you needed. There was no question in anyone's mind that they meant it, that we go on strike. And on strike we went.
This has gone down in history as the uprising of the 20,000. Because all of these shirtwaist makers go out on strike.
I shall probably never forget that day. It was cold, windy, but the people from the factory just poured into the streets through Union Square and filled the halls which were rented for that occasion.
Historian Tony Michaels.
The great 1909 uprising of the 20,000 was a strike predominantly of women, the majority of whom were Jews, the minority were Italian. Here you see young women, many of them in their teens, who led the strike, who did a lot of the organizational legwork, who helped to see it through.
The strike lasted from November to late in March of 1910.
It was not an atmosphere in New York City at the time that favored strikers. And so women would be arrested by the police. Judges would sentence them to fines or, in some cases, prison. The owners of the factories would hire prostitutes to go and taunt the women. So Clara Lemlich herself had ribs broken.
In these strikes, over and over again, you see young women doing battle, physical battle often, in a way that was inconceivable in Eastern Europe.
Interestingly enough, allies of these women came from uptown, women who were members of the Women's Trade Union League who were anxious to get women the vote, would come down and strike alongside them. These were non-Jewish women, some of quite wealthy families, and so this made it much more difficult for the police to arrest the women because they didn't want to arrest an uptown woman. They were also called, because when it was cold, they would wear their mink coats, and so they were called the Mink Brigade.
The strike is a mixed bag. They get some firms to settle, but not all of them.
Deborah Dashmore, professor of Jewish history at the University of Michigan.
We didn't get everything we wanted, but you never do. You compromise. But the hours were limited to 54 a week. And the wages were raised.
One of the firms that doesn't settle is the Triangle Shirtwaist Makers.
The presser, the cutter, the ringer, the mangle, the needle, the union, the treadle, the bobbin, the code. The infamous blaze at the Triangle factory in 1911.
In 1911, on a Saturday, the women are working at this Triangle shirtwaist factory, and all of a sudden, a fire bursts out. There was enormous numbers of rags around, which is probably how the fire began. And the fire doors have been locked.
The most victim, I think, was on the 8th floor, the floor that I worked. And the most tragedy was in the dressing room. They went for their clothes. In fact, I had a brand new suit because I was going to go out. I was changing my skirt and I saw that fire and I wanted to help. I was going to take a bucket of water and pour it on the fire. And before you know, my hair was singed.
When we got down, we saw the three flights burning. The wind was blowing all up and everything was caught. One, two, three, the three flights, the office and everything were burning.
I was living on Stanton Avenue. It's about a mile to the factory. The whole East Side was there watching the girls. The fire department couldn't get to the girls because the door was locked from the outside in case the girl steals a blouse. She has to be watched when she's walking out.
they can't get out to the fire escapes, and they begin to climb out the windows, and they realize as the fire trucks come to this very modern fireproof building that the ladders don't reach up to the 8th and 9th floor. They only go as far as the 6th. And the only thing left is to jump from the windows, but the nets aren't strong enough to catch them.
The people, our bodies, it was terrible. We got sick. That was a sight to see.
146 died in the flames on the 9th floor. No hydrants, no fire escapes. The witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out away from the masonry wall and let her drop. And then another, as if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar, and not eternity.
My sister was burned to death, and she was so badly burned that we couldn't recognize her. If the door on the 9th floor would have been open, I think most of the people would have been safe.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray.
The mothers or the family of the dead were screaming blue murder. At the time, nobody knows about history, but that's the time when people awaken to the idea of what they did to those women.
Bread and roses, bread and roses.
Rose Schneiderman was a fiery speaker and an activist, goes to a meeting in Carnegie Hall of wealthy members of the Women's Trade Union League, and she says to them, "Your money isn't going to help us. What we need are unions. What we need are decent laws." And it's the absence of unions that allowed this triangle shirtwaist fire to occur. The owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory were Jewish. They were exploiting their fellow Jews. When they were brought to court on grounds that they had not followed the fire safety laws, they managed, in fact, to get off with only a fine, and they set up shop again.
Historian Annie Poland.
Rose Schneiderman, Clara Lemlich, Pauline Newman. These were women who then went on to take up leadership positions in the unions and didn't always have an easy time of it. Rose Schneiderman went to work for the Women's Trade Union League for a while. She had a hard time of it because she was a socialist and these uptown women weren't. On the other hand, when they were associated with the unions with Jewish men who were socialists too, and they shared that ideology and they shared that common background, what held them back was that they were women.
Tony Michaels.
In the Jewish labor movement, there were two main goals. One was to overturn the economic system of exploitation that was capitalism. The other half of the project was to transform immigrant Jews themselves.
The unions were more than just politics. So if you went to a gathering with your shop workers, sometimes it was to organize a strike, but in other cases it was to learn, to have reading circles.
That's why you can walk around Manhattan and see union cooperative housing. There were schools and summer camps provided by the unions.
On Sunday mornings, when we didn't have to go into the shop, we went to lectures, and the man who lectured, Hugh Pentecost, we would come 11 o'clock, and Mr. Pentecost would lecture on current events. He was, as I remember, a philosophical anarchist. And we would go there as the religious people would go to a synagogue.
New York City in 1916, 1917 was a hub of revolutionary activity. You would see not just Trotsky was here, Nikolai Bukharin was here, David Ben-Gurion was here, of course, the future prime minister of Israel. In an earlier period of time, Catherine Breshkovskaya was here. She was regarded as the grandmother of the Russian Revolution. So in any number of ways, you couldn't go outside your door and not be aware that there was something called socialism in the air on the Lower East Side.
These were people who believed in the American dream. For many of those people, socialism was their new religion. They lived and breathed socialism.
A lot of them viewed the American Revolution as an incomplete revolution, a major advance forward in establishing political democracy, but it fell short because it left in place a capitalist system that promoted economic inequality. There was a very strong optimism. All of the socialists were convinced, up until World War I, that socialism would be achieved in their lifetime in the United States. Not only were hundreds of thousands of Jews in socialist-led unions and reading socialist Yiddish newspapers, they also elected a whole string of Socialist Party candidates to office between 1914 and 1919. Jews did come to be viewed as closely associated with communism and subversion in the United States, and it was a serious liability for them. This was a stereotype that really consolidates around the Red Scare in 1919, and it would exist through the early 50s and the McCarthy period. The stereotype of the radical Jew was fairly accurate, at least as stereotypes go, but that's different from the charge of Jews as communist agents or Bolsheviks. Emma Goldman is an immigrant Jewish woman who was an anarchist, a beloved figure among many immigrant Jews, and of course a notorious figure in the American public at large. She's viewed as a very dangerous woman. The irony here is that she was an opponent to Bolshevism. Even as she was deported to the Soviet Union on principle as an anarchist, she opposed Lenin. But nonetheless, in the public mind, here's just one more example of the Jewish radical, the dangerous Jewish Red. Not all Jews on the Lower East Side were socialists, but what I would say is that socialists were able to articulate the mood, the values, the idioms of an immigrant Jewish community in upheaval and turmoil.
These values were expressed in the Yiddish culture and artistic life of the Lower East Side, in literature, music, theater, and on radio. You're listening to Becoming Americans, part two of a journey through the Jewish Lower East Side of New York. I'm Larry Josephson. We'll be back in a minute.